Welcome to the Art of Healthcare podcast, where we aim to be as good at the human side of healthcare as we are at the clinical side of healthcare. My name is Chris Desmond. I'm a physiotherapist who's fascinated by how we can better help the person with the problem. Join us as we learn how to connect better, how to show up better, and how to understand our patients and ourselves better. Welcome to the Art of Healthcare podcast. This is a show where we explore the human side of healthcare with experts so we can get better at helping the person with the problem. Today, I am joined by Eva Villalba. Eva is a passionate healthcare advocate and transformation champion. She's a catalyst for change focused on value-based healthcare, patient engagement and partnership, and humanizing healthcare through empowering and mobilizing communities, meaningful partnerships, and public policy work. Eva, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
It's an absolute pleasure. I want to kick things off with the question, why are you interested in the art of healthcare? Why do you care about the human side of healthcare?
Well, I think that for a really long time, as a society in general, we've kind of forgotten the reason for healthcare. And that is to make people and communities healthier. And so I love your angle of looking at the art of healthcare and not just the clinical side or the production side, but really looking at, you know, the people behind the work, behind healthcare, not just the people with illnesses or with healthcare problems, but also the professionals that are delivering that, you know, and how does that all relate to a more human-centered.
And what's led you to feeling that way?
Well, I'm a patient advocate in oncology in Canada, and my concern is really doing public policy work and advocacy to make sure that our healthcare systems are actually equitably taking care of, you know, our communities and making sure that no one gets left behind and treated properly to ensure the best healthcare outcomes. But in order to do that, I think we have to treat individuals as people, as we would like to be treated, you know? And so that's really what led me to this kind of thinking and the work that I'm doing in patient advocacy and in value-based healthcare transformation.
Fantastic. Question for you is, what is value-based healthcare? Like, how do we define that? How do we think about that?
So value-based healthcare is a concept that, you know, people have been throwing around like a buzzword for a little while now, since about 2006. And really what that means is that when we talk about value in healthcare, we talk about value from the perspective of the individual with the health concern. So it's really about improving health outcomes for the person over their entire trajectory of care. And so it's a much more holistic vision of what matters in healthcare. What is value? Value is actually improving the health of people. And currently, that is not how we measure value in our healthcare systems. In general, we look at, you know, what is good for the healthcare system, or even at the best, what is good for the healthcare providers or the hospitals. But that's a very narrow view, which doesn't necessarily result in an improvement in healthcare outcomes for patients. For example, in oncology and cancer, often doctors will look at, you know, treating your cancer, improving your, you know, curing your cancer. But are they making sure that you have appropriate mobility? Are they making sure that, you know, you don't have side effects like incontinence or erectile dysfunction following a cancer surgery? And so that very narrow view leads to fixing one thing, but leaving the person with other significant health effects that will actually, you know, burden the healthcare system, ruin their quality of life. And so that's not a holistic view of healthcare. And what's also detrimental is that by having this traditionally very hospital-centered approach, we forget about all of the other important, you know, healthcare services and professionals that can actually help us to improve the quality of life. For example, physiotherapy. So if you actually do physiotherapy before a surgery and after a surgery, you can decrease the negative side effects of erectile dysfunction, of incontinence, of having limited mobility. For example, many women who have breast cancer surgery have issues raising their arms afterwards. But if you think in advance of how do we make this person's quality of life better, and we act proactively, so we aim to improve the value for that person, then we actually include things like physiotherapy, like psychosocial support, oncofertility services, you know? And so it's really a different approach, which puts the individual first, because the care team actually has the conversation about what are the outcomes that matter to you as an individual, besides, you know, binary choices like having or not having cancer. What else matters to you? What does quality of life mean to you? And then let's do everything we can with all of the healthcare professionals, not just doctors, but nurses, physios, you know, nutritionists, psychosocial support. What else can we bring into this trajectory of care to make sure that the person ends up returning to their community, not just not having cancer, but actually feeling well and actually having a quality of life and being able to continue in whatever their new normal life is going to be?
Thank you for that definition.
It's a little long. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's good. It's good. These are conversations that need to happen, I guess, early on in the piece of someone's healthcare journey. Who is the best place to have that conversation, do you think?
So that's a great question. And, you know, I think that a lot of the places that are starting to implement value-based healthcare, we often think that it must start in the hospitals. You can actually apply value-based healthcare in a primary care clinic or in a community practice. It's really just about starting by having the conversation with the patient about what are the outcomes that matter to them. So for example, I had knee surgery a few years ago, a random soccer accident. You know, like I just twisted my knee, I tore my meniscus, and then I went to get surgery. Unfortunately, my orthopedic surgeon and following that, my physio, we never had the conversation about what do I want besides repairing my knee. I wanted to be able to play soccer again. That's what I really wanted. And my trajectory would have been different if that was part of the plan. But the plan was only, it's a very break and fix approach instead of a predict and prevent. How can we predict and prevent the worst outcomes from happening? And so I think that this is something that can be applied in any clinical setting, ideally by working together as a team. So the doctors and the nurses and the psychosocial support and the rehab team can all share that information about what matters most to the patient and actually design a trajectory of care that will get them to that outcome, like playing soccer again. In my case, I had to grieve the loss of my soccer legs, and now I, you know, bike ride instead. But that could have been avoided. And I know other people that did have that conversation, got a different type of brace, did a different type of physiotherapy, and were able to play soccer again. So that's just one like very specific example. But in something more serious like oncology, it could be a conversation with a primary care doctor, like a family practitioner, a GP, or it could be even with your nursing care. Like, what are your symptoms and how do we deal with, even though they're not directly, you know, about treating your cancer, are you having digestive issues that are actually ruining your quality of life? Are you concerned about possible incontinence? Sometimes patients don't even know what's coming up. So even including the person, giving them the information that they need to understand what's coming next, and allowing them to be a real partner in their own care by giving them the tools that they need to make informed decisions, I think that can be done in all clinical settings.
And I think, like, listening to you there, it is about exploring more than just fixing the problem. And I know from being a clinician and asking people, actually, hey, what do you want from this? Usually the first answer is to fix my problem. And I think often that's the easy answer for us, just to leave there. And I think some people do try to probe a little bit deeper and actually, okay, what other stuff do you want? And at least to start with, some people just remain fixated on let's fix this problem, which is obviously an important part of the process. But I really like what you were talking about there in terms of the predict and prevent approach as well, is because we as healthcare providers, we know that there are like a range of usual challenges that people are going to face as they go through this. So we can say, I guess, hey, look, other people often experience this on their journey. Is this something that you've thought about? Is this something that might be important to you that we can look to address before it happens? Do you have any other suggestions of kind of ways into that conversation for healthcare providers to talk about values and explore values for people?
Absolutely. And so I think that sometimes people don't even understand or realize that they can talk about other things besides fix my very concrete problem. And so it's a paradigm shift that has to happen on both sides of the bench, you know? And so I think that by asking people, you know, what are things that bring them joy? Like, what do they like doing? You know, what did they do before that they're worried that they will not be able to do anymore? In my case, it was soccer, you know, but what makes their life better, right? So when you're talking about quality of life, it can be difficult for people to articulate what that means to them, especially if they don't know, like you just mentioned, what's around the bend, what's on the other side. They don't know what usually happens with people with this condition. And so you as healthcare professionals are in a better situation to say, okay, this is what sometimes happens. How would you feel if that happened? Let's see if we can actually proactively address that. You know, if you do, and for example, when you propose, you know, treatment plans or different healthcare options, if you say, well, not only this is what you should do, but this is why you should do it. For example, if you don't do exercise following a surgery, you will lose the ability to move in the same way that you did before your surgery, for example, you know, and so explaining the why, basically putting yourself in the other person's shoes, pretend that you're speaking to someone that you really love and care about, like in your own family. What would you want them to know? You know, and so, and helping them to make informed decisions about things that they might not know about. But I think it really starts with not asking people what do they need, because they might not know exactly what they need, but actually posing the question in a way that allows you to get that information, like what is important to you? What are things that you love doing that you're concerned that you will not be able to do? And let me help you work on that, as well as very obvious concrete clinical problem.
Thank you for sharing that. That's, again, really, really helpful. And I think the understanding the why you're giving someone a certain treatment as well is really, really important, and being able to tie it back to something that is valuable for them. So for example, it's, hey, I'm going to give you some lunges to go away and do as an exercise. And the person is thinking, why are you going to get me to do lunges? Lunges are hard. Lunges are annoying. I don't really meet anyone that likes lunges, but I'm going to give you some lunges to do so that we can work on the deceleration phase of your knee. So when you're playing football, you can slow down and change direction more easily than if we didn't do this. So your agility is going to be better as we get you back to playing football or playing soccer. And I think,
and sorry, Chris, but you know, the other thing is that by having healthcare professionals actually take an interest in the quality of life of the person and their satisfaction with life and their experience, what we've seen is that healthcare professionals actually feel more satisfied in their work because it humanizes them as well. And so by treating people as, you know, not a problem to fix, but as, let me accompany you on your journey of getting better and better and wellness with all that encompasses, having that more holistic approach to the person is definitely beneficial from the person receiving it, but also to the person giving that kind of care. It's actually much more rewarding than just come in here, I'll tell you what to do, you may or may not do it, but I've done my job. That is not as satisfying, because when you see that person again and they're not doing better, you know, you as a healthcare professional will not feel as satisfied as if they come in with a great smile and they tell you how their life is so much better because of your intervention.
Yeah, I completely agree with that in terms of, I mean, some days you have days where you're just trying to get through the day as a healthcare provider. So you're very biomedical in your approach, which is unfortunate, but you leave the day, you feel far less satisfied. And I think that's probably a large part. The systems that we work within are set up in that biomedical way. And there's also a high number of healthcare providers who experience symptoms of burnout. And I'm not sure of the data on this. I'm just spitballing here, but I would hazard a guess, though, those two are probably correlated if there's not a causative effect with that. So, I mean, the conversations are really important from a patient perspective, but also from a healthcare provider quality of work life perspective as well, I think. One other thing that I wanted to just talk about on that as well is that these aren't one and done conversations. These aren't something that you have a conversation with that person right at the beginning of the treatment and then just leave it there. I think that they're kind of ongoing, evolving conversations the way that I see it, for a variety of reasons. One, the person probably doesn't trust you that much when they first come and see you as well, so they may not be happy sharing all of the information they would otherwise. So you might find out more on the fourth or fifth conversation that you have with them than you do on the first. But also people's values evolve through a healthcare, or become more apparent maybe through a healthcare journey as well, as that when people are in the middle of this challenge, maybe they've had surgery and there's new stuff coming up for them that they need to talk about. It's important to kind of keep these value-based conversations going, I think, isn't it?
And yes, absolutely. And one essential part that we haven't discussed yet is that in order to have value-based healthcare, there actually does need to be some measurement, but it's what is measured which is different. Mm. Okay, so, and you're measuring it throughout the entire trajectory, not just at that one time when the person is hospitalized, for example, but from the moment that the health issue presents itself to the moment where the person returns to their regular life. And so that measurement, normally what our healthcare systems do is they have clinical measurements. Okay, so your meniscus is torn in two areas for 2 inches or 2 centimeters, you know, and this is how it will repair itself. But besides the clinical, or you have cancer, it's this stage, you know, we also have to measure patient-reported outcomes through PROMs, or patient-reported outcome measures, and PREMs, which is patient-reported experience measures. And to your point, you don't measure it once. So you measure, the PROMs are usually more outcomes related to quality of life. And Elizabeth Teisberg, who wrote the book with Michael Porter on value-based healthcare, she has this approach of talking about comfort, capability, and calm, in terms of what are the outcomes that matter to patients. So there's actually a whole set of international PROMs sets. So by ICHOM. ICHOM is the International Consortium of Health Outcomes Measurement. And they have entire standard sets of these are the PROMs that you should be measuring for arthritis, for prostate cancer, for a number of different conditions. There's about 40 of them. And so they're validated clinical measures, but of patient reported outcomes. So of quality of life measures. And that way you can see, you know, what is your baseline? How does it improve? And how do we as healthcare professionals actually adjust the way that we address these issues for patients or for people with these conditions so that we can ensure that they get the best health outcomes possible, not just on one front, but on all of their health. And then the PREMs, the patient-reported experience measures, those are not, you know, satisfaction with the cafeteria food. That's traditionally what, you know, when you asked, you know, when you asked patients, you know, how did you find your stay at our hospital? Oh, the parking was terrible. Like, that's not useful at all in value-based care. But the questions about PREMS are more, did you feel that your care team listened to you and understood your health goals? Did you feel like you had to repeat your own, you know, medical history, like a tragic game of telephone several times? And I'm simplifying, obviously, right? But it's that kind of measure. And that is something that needs to be tracked regularly, to your point, you know, not just that one time, but how do we actually have this continuous improvement of the healthcare experience for the patient and react to it, be proactive, and actually modify the trajectory of care based on that new and important data. So whether you're at a hospital or whether you're in a community type clinic, you can actually measure what matters to patients in a very objective and sometimes subjective, but still very useful way and seeing how that improves with your intervention. And the central part is to actually work as an integrated care team with other professionals that can actually benefit from the information that you're collecting as one healthcare professional, but it would help you to know what the nurse saw or what the psychosocial support or what the surgeon saw. And so without that sharing of health data, it's very hard to have a holistic approach to the person, right? So that's also a very value-based concept, is to have integrated practice units or teams that work as a real team and not as a multidisciplinary group. Because that's what we have. The difference between groups and teams is that groups can have different perspectives, but they all have their own data silos. They all do their own thing in their own space, and they don't necessarily share their information, and they don't work together as a team. A team communicates better. A team has the same shared information, and a team is working together towards a common goal. So that's another aspect of value-based care that I think would be beneficial at all levels, is to really ensure that we have the information necessary to improve the trajectory of care, whether it be at a hospital or not, but doing it with the patient, the person at the center, right? So the information should follow the person and not the person having to repeat their own information, which is difficult for them to communicate each time.
And are there resources for the experience measures either? Like a bunch of outcome measures, are there similar things for experience measures for patients, or are these questions that people need to kind of go through within their own team?
That's a great question, because there has been a lot more research and work on patient-reported outcomes measures. And patient-reported experience, we're starting to work on some. And I know that there's work being done internationally on this, but it's more in publications right now. And so it hasn't been as standardized as for the PROMs, because with PROMs, we're talking more about very measurable, it's more quantitative, and there's been a lot more work on it. Whereas PREMs is very qualitative, but just as important, you know. And what we've seen, you know, to the point that we were making before, is that it improves the experience for patients, but it also improves the satisfaction for healthcare providers. And it helps them to know that they're making a difference in someone's life. And it helps them to know that they are really taking the time to understand people. And ultimately, you know, what is humanizing healthcare all about? It's really about making that connection with another person. And so I think that there's a lot less that has been done, and there's a lot less standardization, but I would invite, you know, your audience to just start thinking about what are the questions that you would want if you were being treated, you know, what would improve your experience in terms of, you know, feeling heard, feeling listened to? What would improve your experience that's not purely clinical? And a lot of it has to do with effective communication with your care team. Do you have what you need to actually make your own decisions about your own health? Do you feel listened to? Do you feel like you're participating in your own care or that you're able to? And so these are all like more generic questions that I think are worth asking. And it can be like a 5-point survey, you know, which is really easy to do and people are used to doing this now. And just a little warning about surveys, you know, neither healthcare professionals nor patients like to be bombarded with surveys that will ultimately change nothing, right? So if you're going to take the time to actually measure either patient-reported outcomes or patient experience, you have to tell people, I am asking you this because it's important for me to know how you're doing so that we can do something about it. So people don't mind filling out surveys as long as it's worth it, as long as there's something in it for me or even for other people. You know, this will help us improve the trajectory of care for other people. No problem. I'll do it. But am I just going to fill this out and it's just going to stay on somebody's desk and no one's going to look at it? Don't waste my time, right? So again, going back to the why, don't just tell people what to do, but why. And if you tell them, I am genuinely interested in knowing how you're doing and making you feel better, you'll get all the information that you want. You know, don't go for like a 50 question survey, but you know, something really direct and to the point, distill it with what matters most to those people. And when in doubt, ask. You know, we need to not assume that we know what people want. And that is what makes value-based healthcare one of the solutions for better health equity. Because up to now, we've just assumed that certain healthcare professionals already know what people need. But there's a lot of diversity in terms of people's needs. We can't assume that we know what they care about unless we actually take the time to ask them. And if we do that systematically for everyone, then we can have better health equity because we will actually listen to the person telling us what they need and not assume and impose some sort of standardized model on them that doesn't work for them and their actual needs.
Yeah, it's not treating people how you would like to be treated. It's treating them how they would like to be treated.
Yes. Yes, that's right.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about patient partnership as well, Eva. We were kind of going back and forth a little bit before this conversation, and you're interested in patient partnership at the micro, meso, and macro level. Could you talk about that? Maybe firstly start with like what do you understand as patient partnership, and then how does it operate at these different levels?
For sure. So there's actually a conceptual model called the Montreal model of patient partnership. And it was developed at the University of Montreal by Dr. Marie-Pascale Poimi and the patient partner Vincent Dumez and a whole bunch of other excellent researchers. And basically this approach is beyond patient centricity. So if we think of the historical culture of healthcare, we started with a very paternalistic model where the doctor was God. You'd never ask questions. You just took what they said at face value. Then more recently, starting in about the 80s until even now, we see patient centricity. So we went from a model that was doing things for patients to a model that was doing things to patients. The patients were at the center. We always think about the patient. That's patient centricity. And patient partnership is actually doing things with patients. So we're actually not doing things towards them or for them, but with them. And in order to do that, we need to recognize that they are experts in their life with the disease, with the condition. Recognizing that this experiential knowledge is actually valuable and important for the care team to understand and include in their decisions. And that in order to have a patient partner as part of the care team, as part of their own care, so that's at the micro level, is really like me with my healthcare provider, and we're equal partners in tackling this health issue that I have. In order to be an equal partner, I need to have all of the information necessary to make informed decisions about my own care. And then ultimately, it's up to me whether or not I will, you know, follow your recommendations or choose option B rather than option A for my treatment course. And so it's a recognition and a respecting of the patient's role in their own care. And that's real patient partnership. So it goes beyond, you know, even at the level of public engagement and participation, you know, you can have like just informing people, you can have collaborating with them or consulting them, you can have implicating them in some peripheral way, or you can have true partnership, which is you're an equal part of the team. We have doctors, we have nurses, we have physiotherapists, and we have the patient. And so at the micro level, it's really, I'm involved in my own care. At the meso level, that is what we're starting to see in Canada a lot and in other parts of the world is hospitals and clinics or even pharmacies are starting to include patient partners on their team so that they can actually benefit from the value of a patient perspective in the design of the healthcare services. Because again, everyone has good intentions, you know, we're assuming. But healthcare professionals definitely want to be thinking of, you know, what their patients would need. But ultimately, there's a bias. You just get used to doing things from your very clinical perspective. And you become detached from the reality of being a patient yourself. And so what we've seen, even in clinical studies, for example, including patient partners in clinical studies, actually helps the researchers to better understand their clinical research question, to develop consent forms that actually are understandable for patients, to recruit patients in a way that they will actually get more patients to participate and to retain, to stay in the clinical trial. If you involve that patient perspective that can actually say, this is gibberish to me. I don't understand what you're telling me. Please rephrase so that I can participate more actively, whether it be in a clinical trial or in my care. And so that inclusion of the patient perspective at the meso level, so at the design of, you know, whether it be clinical trials or the design of, you know, we're going to improve the trajectory of radiotherapy or of, you know, rectal cancer surgery. And so having that patient perspective helps the entire team to actually improve, continuously improve how they're delivering those healthcare services. And then at the macro level, which is what interests me the most, because a lot of what we do as patient advocates is really, you know, at the public policy level, how do we improve public policy in public healthcare systems to actually deliver better care for patients and not just healthcare services? People don't want more healthcare services. They want more health. And so if we give them better health, they should be using the services less. But no one's going to run out of work because, you know, the population keeps getting older and we have unlimited numbers of problems. But at least if we focus on giving them health, that can improve. And so a patient partnership at that macro level is using that experiential knowledge of living with the disease or the condition and actually being an equal partner on some of these, you know, decisional committees of the government or of the healthcare systems that will actually make suggestions to improve from the perspective of the patient. Because ultimately, that is a perspective that has been missing in how we design our healthcare systems. That human side of how does the end user feel about this? You know, and I think that that paradigm shift of thinking, who are we doing this for? If we really include the people that we're doing it for and we include their perspectives, I think it's just a win-win situation for everyone. I think that what's best for patients is good for the system, is good for healthcare professionals, but not always vice versa.
And it's what so many other service industries do already.
Exactly.
In terms of user experience. And
exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah. We're a bit slow to the party, I think. Again, probably for a variety of reasons. Thank you for explaining that and explaining what that looks like at each different stage and the importance of it as well. And it's easy for me to see now and kind of conceptualize as like, okay, yeah, we obviously need to do this in the clinical setting, but at all of these other areas, if we do it well there, that means that what happens in that clinical setting probably happens more easily because of the other stuff that has happened above it already.
Exactly. And I mean, I would invite you, let's say in your own clinic, if you would invite a representative sample of your clients, of your patients, and you have to actually go for representation, right? Don't just pick the like top
the ones you like,
easy ones, right? The ones you like, the ones that, you know, are of higher socioeconomic status and super high literacy. You're just going to get the answers that you expect. Actually try to get diversity of all of your clients. Who are underserved? Who has more problems? Who has perhaps not the same grasp of, you know, they might not have the medical literacy. They might have more insurance problems or whatnot, right? And then you have that diversity and then you say, okay, this is what we would like to do. What do you think? We're very open. Ensure you have that psychological safety where they could actually tell you what they think. And I guarantee you that your practice will benefit. Because there are things that are under your radar that you don't necessarily see. People might not complain about it. But by having that input, you make their lives better. You make your services respond to their actual needs. But at the same time, it allows you to understand perhaps inequities that you might not have perceived yourself through no fault of your own, you know. But if you don't ask, you won't know. So actually asking and actually saying, what do you think that we can improve? And actually taking the time and caring about what that answer is. And then, you know, committing to apply it, committing to do something about it. Well, I never read these forms because the print is so small that, you know, I just sign, but I have no idea what I'm signing for. Like that would be a very useful feedback, right? Or, yeah, I get the confirmation. The receptionist tells me that I get the confirmation emails, but I don't even have high-speed internet or I don't have a smartphone. Or, okay, have you thought of all these things, right? And that applies as much to the healthcare services as it does to the actual, how do their outcomes improve or not? Because what you're attempting to do doesn't actually reach everyone in the same way, right? Or I really prefer speaking to this one healthcare provider than the other one, because they always ask me how my day was. And then you can actually see like, what are the best practices in your clinic, for example, and how can everyone do these best practices? You know, what are the things that we should be doing more of? What are the things that we should be doing less of? And the way that you do that is by just asking people and not assuming. Mm-hmm. But by including them, by actually recognizing that they have something valuable to contribute as equal partners.
Yeah. Eva, I usually ask people at the end, what's the practical thing that we should do tomorrow off the back of this conversation? But I think you might have just answered that. If you want to expand at all, then go for it. But if you're happy just to leave it to sit there, then that's cool as well.
Yeah. I think we definitely gave some very concrete examples of how to humanize healthcare, of how to integrate patient partnership and how to really apply value-based healthcare principles at all levels of care.
I think we did as well. If people are interested in you and the work that you do, would like to connect, what's the best way that they can do that? How can they go about that?
I'm a very big fan of LinkedIn, so I would invite anyone just to reach out to me on LinkedIn. And otherwise, yeah, no, that's definitely the way that I would invite people to reach out to me. I'm very responsive, as you know.
You are. That's where we connected. I also really enjoy LinkedIn. Eva, before we finish up, I'd love for you just to pose a question to us to get us to think a little bit more deeply on this area of our practice and maybe kind of reflect on what we do so that we can evolve our practice a little bit.
So I would actually invite your audience to really think about what matters most to the people that you're treating. So how can you find out what matters most? And it's a very simple answer. It's a very simple question, but you don't have to overthink it, right? Like, don't do it if you don't feel that it'll be perfect or that you might be awkward. I would just invite people to actually think about how to understand what matters most to the people that they're treating. And if they don't know how to ask that question, you can just be honest and say, I'm not sure how to do this, but I really want to understand what matters most to you so that I can help you achieve it. And it's as simple as that. And it will make such a great difference in the lives of the people that you're treating. But also, I really believe that it does improve, and there is some evidence to demonstrate this, it does improve your satisfaction as a healthcare professional as well. So that's definitely what I would end with, is what matters most to the patients that you treat.
Fantastic. Eva, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much, Chris.
That's a wrap, team. I really hope you enjoyed that one. If you want to support the show, the best way you can do that is to share this episode out with your friends, your colleagues, your mum, someone who you think might enjoy it, and to make sure that you hit subscribe on your favorite podcast app so you never miss an episode. For more resources for all the episodes, for more information about the Art of Healthcare team, head on over to artofhealthcare.nz and you can find all of that stuff there. The amazing theme music for the episode was produced by my brother Jeremy Desmond, but otherwise you can blame me and my wonderful guest for the rest of the stuff. Thank you guys again so much for tuning in. Thanks for listening. Thanks for sharing. Thanks for showing the love. I really appreciate you. Have a great week.